Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. As always, before we jump into the episode, I do have to do some housekeeping, which is the promotion of our Patreon. So the Patreon is the only way that we're able to keep running the podcast. It's the only sort of financial income we get, and it does help to pay the people behind the scenes, the editors, the social media side of things, and get new equipment so we can do better quality recordings. So it starts at £3 a month, which works out about 10p a day. You get a bonus episode every single week, and that is a Q&A that we do with our guests after the live show. And you can submit your questions either before or during the episode. So one of the other bonuses is that you can watch the episodes live. They're always a lot of fun. There's a live chat featured whilst the episode's going on, so you can have a little conversation in there. Aside from the main show, you also get access to our Discord server, where it's just a community of people, all like-minded. They enjoy the podcast, and it's a very nice little community that we've built over the years. You're also going to get ad-free episodes, early access to all of them. There's a bunch of different reasons why you should support the Patreon, and in the new year we're also going to be adding some new tiers, rewards, and we're going to give it a little bit of a revamp. So yeah, if you can, please do head over to patreon.com/Nordic Mythology Podcast. Obviously not everybody can support financially, so if you can, even just a like, share, comment, all that kind of stuff that you can do on the social media really does help us keep going and keep finding new audiences. And that's just Nordic Mythology Podcast on all the different channels. But that's enough of that. Let's get into today's show. And today I'm joined by Frederick Gregorius. Frederick, thank you for joining me. I think we met a while back at Midgasplot, maybe 18 months ago, maybe now.
Yeah, in 2022. Mm-hmm.
Not the one just gone, the one before that.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, thank you for joining me. Do you want to give maybe a little introduction into who you are, what you do?
I'm an associate professor at Linköping University in Sweden, in history of religion, that would be, and currently working on a project called Back to Blood, which is about the reception and use of old Norse mythology and religion and culture in contemporary society, and the different kind of reasons behind people are using old Norse religion.
Mm-hmm. So...
I just had to say also that it's a collaboration between Stavanger University and Linköping University, and funded by the Norwegian Research Council. Yes, so we can add it to our outreach.
Keep everybody happy.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're going to look at how Old Norse religions have been used in different contexts. And we said at the start, before the show, because we always have a little bit of a chat, how, or at least I noticed how every time we look at Old Norse religion, typically on this podcast, outside of the Viking Age, it tends to be the Nazis, because that's kind of the people who maybe have used it the most, other than possibly the Victorians, I guess. But we're going to look all the way back to the 1600s, am I right?
And
through and see how it's been used.
Yeah, and I think that also... I think there is a slight over exaggeration regarding the use of like Nordic mythology by the Nazis. And I think that considering that there's many of the areas, particularly Hitler was not particularly fond of it, as I think is quite well known. It was something that Himmler was mainly into. But that is another side of the story. So.
We can kind of start there. Why do you think that is, that there is this idea that... because there is this kind of idea that the Nazis adored all things Viking, all things mythology. And it does seem to run through even today. You know, you have like neo-Nazis, modern, whatever you want to call them, who do associate and use these symbols.
I think there are different reasons, but I think one reason is that like National Socialism grew out of a similar kind of environment that started to romanticize like Old Norse religion and Viking Age mythology. Not always in a sense of admiring it, that sometimes it could be used as a kind of, for example, in Wagner's operas, for example, the Nordic gods were often seen as being not entirely positive creatures. They were seen as sometimes in the, at least the first the Rheingolden, not how to pronounce it, where the gods basically are representatives of the old bourgeoisie who were sort of in decay and decline. But I think it created this image of that it seems the Nazis, the National Socialist movement were, of course, from Germany. They were nationalists. They were talking about Aryan race and Aryan heritage and everything. So it was quite logical to associate it with a use of, like, of course, Germanic and Old Norse religion. And there were definitely sections that did use it. The Annarbe within the SS, of course, had a, although they had a very peculiar take on it, and they had a very perhaps a quite eccentric interpretation of it. But you also have, of course, a use in the Nordic countries, where in Norway they use the references to the Vikings to get people to join the SS. But I think that to a degree, if the National Socialist would have appeared in another country, we would have sort of associated them with that kind of culture and the references they made there. But if you actually look at the writings, you can still see that the primary inspiration that, for example, Hitler had was more towards Greek and Roman culture. That was when it came to his ideal of a new capital city was more based on Greek and Roman architecture than Norse mythology. But there was a sense, of course, there were people within the particular Völkisch movement that appeared before, that was kind of a precursor to the Nazis. They definitely had a stronger idea about reviving old Germanic values and old Germanic culture. But I think it's an interesting story. But I think that it has become a little bit over exaggerated, to say the least. And I think, but I think the main thing that the really big thing happens after World War II, when you have a smaller neo-Nazi movement that is much more a fringe movement, subculture, that where sort of more eccentric ideas become more generally accepted than, for example, a big major movement. You can see it, for example, in nationalist movement in Europe today, where you see a lot more focusing on the heritage of Christianity than the Viking Age. If you would have gone back like 30 years, many of the kind of movements would have been much more into blutes and Viking ceremonies than they are today. And I think it was the same when in reverse with the neo-Nazi, with the Nazi, when neo-Nazis emerged, they were a fringe movement, they were a sort of small movement, and it was easier for fringe ideas to basically become normative or get a larger impact or influence.
Is there a reason, okay, is it even possible to pinpoint a reason as to why the Nordic side of things stuck to the Nazis? Whereas if they were more interested in Roman Greek, certainly to, like, I guess the everyday person, or at least I don't associate Nazis or Nazi Germany with Greek and Roman. It's always is that kind of Nordic thing, but maybe that's because I've done this and I've spoken about it a bunch as well.
I think it's because for some, I think there's a larger cultural reception of Greece and Rome that we don't associate with fascism and national socialism. But if you look, for example, in Italy, their main focus was, of course, the Roman Empire. And you also have people like Julius Evola, the traditionalist writer, who definitely was more into the Romans, and he talks about pagan imperialism and things like that. But no, it has been sort of we don't associate it with that, and I think, but I think it has to do with the cultural setting we are in, and also the fact that many movements that came particularly after World War II, they did embrace and use a lot, and some of the earliest form of what we might call heathenism or modern day also true definitely had a more racial interpretation, like the Anglican Church of Odin, I think it was called in Australia, or maybe it was New Zealand. I don't exactly. Mills was the guy's name, but they had a more they were clearly like a neo-Nazi association, and you also had, of course, Else Christensen with the Odinist Fellowship, who also was label herself as a national socialist or a national syndicalist originally. So I think that the reception when it came to, like, particularly new religious movement and spiritual movements using Nordic stuff. It was very early on associated with ideas about race and identity, and could easily be integrated with a small neo-Nazi movement. But it's, if you actually look, and now we're not going to talk about Nazis, but if you actually look at the spiritual belief system among the Nazis, it's much more complicated. It's much more, you have references to, yeah, Greek and Roman and Hinduism and Islam. And there was it's a surprising wide variety of spiritual ideas existing within the Nazi movement, but also within the far right generally. I mean, for example, Savitri Devi, who believed that Hitler was an avatar, she was, of course, into Hinduism. That was her main thing. So, but we don't talk about Hinduism, but we should,
No.
because they're talking about it's a small fringe movement.
No, I guess you don't. You never hear about that with them. But okay, I don't want to spend too much time on the Nazis, just because it's a topic we've covered a lot when it comes to Nordic mythology, Nordic Old Norse religion, whatever. So I want to, I guess, go back as far as we can and see when, may I don't know if it's the obsession is the right word, but when people outside of maybe the Vikings start to really be super interested in this, or when we can see it being used in culture, I guess. You know, you said before, like the 1600s.
Yeah, it starts. I mean, Sweden is one of the few areas where Sweden seems to be quite early on. Most of the time, Sweden tend to be following the rest of Europe. But when it comes to the Jews, it wasn't originally a reference to the Viking Age. It was to the Gothic tribes that they were admiring, but pre-Christian culture basically, and it emerges in the 1600s, something called the Gothic movement. That was based on the idea that the Gothic tribes, who were descendants from Scandinavia, that they come from Sweden. That was the main argument. And this was a period in Sweden's history where Sweden was basically becoming a new power player in European history. So they also, if you know, a new empire needs a grand history. So you have to kind of create a very sort of extravagant history, to say the least, one is to put it mildly. And the Gothic movement in the 1600s is a very interesting, to me, I think it's a very interesting intellectual history. It's based on the whole basic idea, seems it was to summarize it then, is that the Gothic tribes were, the reasoning is a bit complicated, but the reasoning went that the Gothic people were the oldest people in Europe, and for that reason, they had the right to more or less rule and conquer the rest of Europe. And of course, the true Gothic tribes were Sweden. So Sweden had sort of a divine mandate to rule the rest of European civilization. I mean, and it was used by Gustav Adolphus, were sort of became the perhaps like the most well-known of those kings who embraced this kind of ideology. And originally it went quite well for Sweden military-wise. They were involved in the 30-Year War, which was also where Gustav Adolphus died, and they started to have the emerging they started to become more and more ideas about Sweden having this kind of divine mission. It wasn't directed towards paganism. It wasn't idea about that there were pagan warriors, but they were The idea was that they were going to be the protector of Protestantism. They were going to be like the defender of the Lutheran Protestant faith against the Catholics, and they had a divine mandate to do this. I think that to understand the Gothic movement in Sweden, one has to go a little bit further, even more back in time, and that is to basically around the 1100s, when Sweden is definitely becoming a Christian nation, or at least publicly Christian nation, depending on how you ask. And I think when, and today, I mean, I think a lot of people find it quite funny, and even that Sweden or Eastern Sweden were the last area to be Christian. It's kind of fun. Yeah, the Danish were sort of they fell first, and then Sweden was the last to fell. But in the Middle Ages, that was not a source of pride. Of course, it was something that was quite embarrassing. That, Sweden was the last country to emerge to to become Christians. So they wanted to have a kind of glorious past or some type of glorious purpose. So it started really quite early on in the, even in the Middle Ages, there were talks about, you know, Sweden being the home of the Gothic tribes. And there was a general acceptance of that in Europe. So it was quite easy to use that idea in the 1600s. And following this, of course, it became stranger after that. You have the first royal librarian and the first also royal antiquarian in Sweden was a man called Johannes Brius, who was originally a teacher of Gustav Adolphus, but later became perhaps one could say a bit more eccentric in his ideas. He started to argue that God probably spoke Swedish, and that if you compare Hebrew and Swedish, Swedish was probably the oldest language in the world. And he tried to prove it, and he also tried to reform the Swedish alphabet and get rid of the Latin alphabet. And instead, everyone should read runes again. And after a while, it became weird. He started to believe that everything in the Bible was actually about him. About him, yeah.
Oh, it was, wow. Okay.
So every time the word John or was mentioned, because his name was Johannes or John Breer, it was actually about him. So that also created...
I don't actually know what to say to that. I'm like...
It
I feel like when you know when a dog's confused and they turn their head. That's what I felt like I did just then. I was like, what?
He was a weird mixture, and I think many of these people were this weird mixture of, in one way, geniuses. I mean, Brius was actually one of the first who actually started to go out in the countryside and write down folklore. He started to write down runestones that we don't have anymore, that are sort of lost to history. At the same time, he was apparently perhaps not the most mentally balanced person you can find. Megalomania, someone says it, yeah. So he started to also claim there was a prophecy from Paracelsus about a lion from the north that was used in Swedish propaganda, of course, that lion of the north was a king, of course, the king who was going to save Europe from the Catholics. But Brie started to claim that it was actually about him as well. So he started to claim that everything was about him. And
it always seems like that when you get somebody who's extremely intelligent, like not just smart, but like that really like 1%, that they also can be a little bit, I don't know what the correct word is. So I'm going to watch my tongue. But I remember there was a kid at school, it's called Henry. I still remember this as clear as day. And he was the smartest guy in the school. He was super intelligent. Like whatever subject, he was just really smart. But also, on a break time, used to just think he was a helicopter and run around the playground pretending he was a helicopter. And this is like, it was just such a juxtaposition of like in the classroom how he's just so intelligent and like switched on, but then this kind of also disconnect outside in their own free time of just like. Not just, yeah. I'm not talking like when we were like tiny little kids, like six. I mean, like,
no,
old enough to not think that you're a helicopter.
Yeah, I think, but I think that, yeah, that, I think, I don't think that's completely uncommon, no. And I think that it was, Boreas was close to believing he was a helicopter. I think if he would have been alive today, and I mean, we can still see, I think it's kind of interesting, you can still find pictures of him, paintings of him. At every, like, at both the University Library in Lund and in Uppsala in Sweden, there's still this because he was, of course, the first royal librarian. That's the reason we have university libraries today. And also the reason why we have the sort of antiquarian, this is a government antiquarian. So he was kind of influential, but yeah, also he was perhaps a bit. It went strange after a while with this idea about runes being, he could see runes in fish scales, and he tried to write a new language based on flowers, and of course the whole of Bible was about him, which put him in some problems. But you can also see, of course, how Sweden was quite clearly a class society during this period, because Brius never really got into trouble with the ecclesiastical authorities. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the same period. They will probably have killed him if he was a peasant, who would say the same thing. But it goes on. I think that the situation with Gothicism remains the same. You when you go forward in time, Breuer's influence was mainly institutional in the way that he created institutions. But in later, you find in the 17th century, you find, of course, perhaps the most famous one, who is Olaus Rudbeck, who's written this very famous book called Atlantica, which is an amazing book. It's four volumes, which claims that everything is from Sweden, and Uppsala is actually the capital of Atlantis, and everything is a copy of everything that happens in world history. It's actually just a copy of the temple in Uppsala, and everything, Greek mythology, Roman mythology, that basically everything happens in reality in Sweden. And that's probably one. And he was also, Rudbeck had a much larger influence than Breus. And this book was published in several different languages.
Okay.
So.
Okay, I'm trying to wrap my head around this. So he thought that everything, all the other religions happened in Uppsala. All the stories that you would read in Greek and Roman mythology, they were taking place in Uppsala.
Not only Uppsala, but in Sweden.
In Sweden.
It is quite an amazing, because he was also a very well-known physician. He discovered, and he's still honored for that. You still go to, I don't remember exactly what he discovered, you can still go to Uppsala. They still have Rudbeckium. They still have places named after him that are not because of his ideas about Sweden being Atlantis, but because of, as a medical researcher, he was quite, he was a product of a type of, I wouldn't call it enlightenment because we are a bit too early for that, but he was a product of a type of Renaissance man in a way. And he did knew and read a lot of languages. His references are both Latin and Greek, and even sometimes Hebrew. But I always find Atlantica an amazing book, or books, because it's actually literally four volumes. And they have, I love the front piece, and I want to have it in my office someday. It's actually a picture of Rudbeck showing Plato, Pythagoras, and all the learned men from the past, the truth, and revealing, sort of lifting the veil, and behind you see Sweden. That's actually where everything originated. And it's, I love the ego in that sense. Also his idea that he's actually sort of, he can sort of reveal the truth of all ancient history. But it's an amazing book. I mean, where you can't
what
think.
If he was, what if he's right?
If he's right, we have to throw out everything we know about linguistics out of the window. Everything we know about archaeology and everything we know about geology. So, yeah.
I mean, I don't. I would. Part of me would love it. Would it, like somebody who just has one of these crazy theories.
Yeah.
If they were actually right and everybody else was wrong, and we were all just like, "Oh shit!" Like that guy we thought who was crazy. They actually got it right, and we were all very wrong.
It would be very fun. It would be very. As I said, we have to kind of. It's sort of the similar to the whole idea that there is a Hindu nationalist idea called something called Out of India, which is a similar idea that everything comes from India originally.
Okay.
The premise is basically the same then, of course, but we're not talking about Uppsala now, we're talking about Vedic story history, that, you know, everything comes from India. But it has the same problem that's not, if we actually look at how Sanskrit is written and developed, we know that can't be the case. That there's really no possible way.
I don't know if this is an apt comparison, but it feels today, and I mentioned crazy Facebook groups on here quite often, but there's a lot of like Viking themed Facebook groups. And there are a lot of people who talk and act as though Scandinavia, Iceland, probably you typically Iceland in particular, are some sort of holy place that where everything origins from. You know, people who are interested in kind of the Viking Age, Nordic mythology, does tend to be Americans. That's not just a jab at Americans. In my personal experience, it does tend to be people from America. Maybe that is because the history is so short and they tend to look back. But there is this kind of almost worship of Scandinavia as something higher than the rest, because their ancestors may have come from there, or they're interested in. And it kind of has that similar feel to what you're describing, or I kind of see on a little scale here, there. And like, I had a gentleman message me the other day on through Horns of Odin, and he was like, do you have anything that was made in Iceland? And I was like, well, no, because we're based in Yorkshire. We make everything here. Obviously, you know, there are things that are inspired by Icelandic and all to do with Nordic mythology, things through the Viking Age, whatever, all that kind of stuff is what we do. He's saying, no, but I really want something made in Iceland. And I was like, I can't really help you with that. And he's like, yeah, it's like the founding place of Ásatrú. And started like telling me all about that. Like in these long messages, I'm like, but what's such the obsession with it having to come from Iceland? It was like almost talking as if Iceland was just like this super, almost like a holy land. I found it quite unusual.
It is, but I think it has to do with the reception, because, I mean, of course, Iceland was colonized, or sort of the Viking or the Nordic people came quite late to. There were some Irish monks there before, but otherwise was uninhabited as far as I know. Mm-hmm. But Iceland was populated around, it's like 900 or something like that. It's quite late. And Norway, the process of Christianization was way on its way already when Iceland was populated. It seems to be, but there is this image definitely. You can sometimes even see it in not as much, but you can definitely see it sometimes in Sweden among in some areas of heathen groups as well, that there is this veneration for Iceland, which is, I think, has to do with a kind of idea. Iceland is a little bit far away. Many people have not been there. It's a small island, and they preserved the language in a way that Norway, Sweden, and Denmark has not. I think that if you the kind of stuff that comes out of Iceland, it seems to be, and that's so, I guess, a little bit disappointing. But it doesn't really seem to be a haven for heathenism or Ásatrú, either today or historically. It became, but I mean, so there is a certain, I mean, it was an isolated area. People didn't know much about it. So I think that it's very easy to romanticize and create an image of Iceland. And I think, when I used to live in Texas, and I was hanging around with very nice, you know, wonderful people from the pagan community there. It's just the same time I did feel that they had a little bit of a weird interpretation of Scandinavia and mm-hmm. Scandinavian culture that perhaps were not really realistic. Most people don't want to talk about the fact that Scandinavian countries are extremely secular, urban, generally not religious at all. And the kind of there is a lot of interesting folklore, of course. You find a lot of interesting stuff, but to claim that we are sort of pagans in waiting is almost becomes a bit. It becomes a bit strange, particularly. I mean, if you ask a random Swede, or perhaps if you ask a random Icelander or Norwegian if they are a heathen or Ásatrú, they will probably stare at you and wonder what you're talking about.
Yeah, I actually feel a lot of people, if they were to visit, I mean, I've driven through Sweden, but I've never stopped and visited. I just drove up through Denmark to get to Norway, so I can't speak too much for Sweden itself, but Norway and Iceland, I think a lot of people, if they went there, they were probably quite disappointed at how, like, everywhere else it is. Everybody's not walking around like a Viking, wishing the old gods were here. It's just pretty normal, just like everywhere else.
Yeah, I think I can speak for Sweden that in that sense as well. Yeah, it's normal. Yeah, it's It's normal secular societies. It's not particularly. It's but it's fun, and I think sometimes, particularly, I think when, and I guess I think sometimes people from Scandinavia find it quite funny, particularly if they are heathens or pagans themselves, when they go abroad to perhaps exaggerate a little bit the
Oh yeah,
impact
okay.
because it makes it more fun to sort of, and that's not to say that it doesn't have an impact or it's not important culturally, but yeah, you do can find this kind of romantic view of Scandinavian culture, and also the idea that Scandinavian culture somehow represents something primordial or original, which is, I mean, it tends to be a little bit strange. I mean, I'm sitting in an apartment here in Stockholm. I don't see, well, I do see some water outside my window, but overall, it's a very urban setting. Yeah, I'm not gonna be able to go out and I don't know, sacrifice to Odin and see hear
Yeah.
some wolf howl into the moon.
But it does seem as though it's romanticized, but it's not just in modern
No.
times either. It's pretty at different points throughout history, there is this romantic lens put on that part of the world, it feels.
Yeah, it has, and I think sometimes things it has been something that's been reused and or used by like Scandinavians themselves. Definitely, it has been used in Scandinavian nationalism. The creation of pan-Scandinavianism in the 19th century used a lot of references to Viking Age and the idea of brother. I mean, Sweden and Denmark have been at war with each other more than basically any other country in the world. But the idea of a common heritage was something that everyone could unite around, and Pan-Scandinavism when become more popular in the 19th century, and so there is a lot of use. And you can see, for example, if you go to there are bridges here in the something called the King's Bridge or something, where there are three or four different Nordic gods that are placed there to represent them in a very, very Greek fashion,
Okay.
but there still is Thor and Heimdall and Frigga and Idun, I think. So they it has been used by these kind of cultures themselves quite often, and it has been used, as I said, for different political reasons. It has been used for nationalism, definitely, but it has also been used by left-wing groups. The idea of actually the idea of, for example, to use Torgny the lawgiver, who was this kind of leader of the peasants. In his own, only mentioned one in Snorri Sturluson. He talks against the king, and that was seen as a kind of representation of a Swedish mentality that, free farmers that dared to go against the king. And you can see it still in the Swedish parliament. There is a big painting in the chamber that usually, or the room that the Social Democratic Party usually use, where you see images of like the Swedish democracy developing. And then the first is basically Torgny, the lawgiver, standing opposed to the king.
Yeah.
And that was a common theme in early national romanticism.
It is fascinating how
Yeah.
even today, it gets used by both sides. You see, obviously, everybody's aware of like how the far right take things and use it, but also the on the left side, you get it's particularly it's romanticizing as women's rights is one that I see romanticized a lot of how women had all these rights and it's all, which is
Yeah.
probably not particularly accurate, but it's put across as though like women were completely free. And also again, like with the democracy side of things, you see that when you're going to Iceland, is there like a big thing that says it was the first democracy or whatever? Now I know Matthias once told me that's bullshit, and it's not accurate, but that it's there. So yeah, it is kind of adopted by both sides of the scale, and I can't think of anything else that is quite the same. And we've spoken about it on here before as how it's adopted by businesses and companies and brands. And it's not even just brands selling things that are related to it. It's brands that do something completely different. They might be making power tools, but it's hit with that Viking moniker because it's powerful.
The Viking can represent anything. Yeah, you have definitely the Viking represents this image of hyper masculinity, of course. So you have to have is a power tool is of course very masculine thing. So you have to have a Viking on it. And you also have, but you also have tea. That I've seen like companies that are selling tea products with tattoos, Vikings, and you definitely see it on both sides. And I think that particularly, well, the idea of the Viking, the feminist Viking, is something that has been really used. And it's complicated because in one way, I'm not an archaeologist, so I'm not going to talk about what we know about the Iron Age society. What I'm interested in is the reception and why we're presented in a certain way. And you can see that it's become very mainstream. There is this, you can, if you actually look at the TV series Vikings, you can see basically by every season, they started to include more and more and more women until you have Vikings Valhalla, where you basically have this whole legions of women warriors. And you can also find it in, there is a big TV show now in Sweden called The History of Sweden, which is, you know, about the history of Sweden from Ice Age until contemporary society. But
I was about to say, but I can't guess what that show is about.
Yeah,
from the title.
Exactly, it's not difficult to understand.
I mean, Scandinavians do tend to be quite literal, so.
Yeah, exactly. We haven't evolved that much since Snorre. But I think it, when you see that today, it's interesting with it because you have this. There is an episode, of course, about the Vikings. You know, of course.
Oh yeah, of course.
And there is a lot of talk about. I always it amuses me when people, you know, talking about, for example, how they lived and how they thought. There is a quite, in my opinion, perhaps not the best episode I've seen about the Bronze Age, where they talk about twin swords representing male and female and the balance between male and female. I said, we don't know. We have no idea what they thought. Mm-hmm. We don't know. They could be representative of two twins, or we don't know anything. But it's a modern idea, of course, the idea of harmony. And but in the Viking episode, you very clearly see there is a mixed presentation of it. One is, of course, based on, you still have to make the Vikings bloodthirsty. And so you have this idea of,
it has to be entertaining as well.
That's, it has to be entertaining. Yeah. So you still have this kind of obsession with human sacrifice. It seems to be coming back despite not really having that much evidence for it. But it's presented as being something very obvious. And people, you know, you have a guy tearing off his shirt and like volunteering, like in the series Vikings. And but the ideas, of course, but it's also presented as all the religious officers are women. So you have, and they do a lot of rather long explanations about what the Völvas were and that they were priestesses and, you know, they were highly honored and everything. I'm not saying it's necessarily wrong, but I'm saying we don't really know. It's a way of, so the question is, why do we present it that way? The reception of it is, of course, there is a reason why we choose to present certain aspects of historical narrative. Mm-hmm. Some ideas are more interesting than others. And here is quite clearly that the new narrative is that the Viking Age were more equal between genders, not necessarily egalitarian because we still had a class system, but definitely more equal between men and women. And it's been used as a kind of reference point for both left-wing interpretations and right-wing, sometimes because right-wing will use it in a more xenophobic way, of course, you know, that Scandinavian women are, you know, oppose migration and presenting of, for example, particularly people from the Middle East as being opposed to Scandinavian ideas about gender equality, although of course generally they don't want gender equality either way. Mm-hmm. But from the more progressive left-wing sides, you definitely see this as being very much embraced and as being seen as an undisputed narrative, basically. And it's also part of this rewriting history to sort of emphasize the role of women, which is a very good thing. But it's interesting how, when it comes out in the public sphere, usually the much more nuanced and complicated aspects disappears, and we get a very sort of rather simplistic narrative in a way. about the situation. And we also presented this as that we know more. And it's one thing I feel when this is done by practicing pagans or people who are just interested in the Viking Age, people going to Viking Age village, because if it's a spiritual and religious aspect, then it's not based on history in the same way. But if it's nationally, if it's a government funded television show, I think more nuance would be appropriate.
Yeah, I think this is an absolutely fascinating discussion, because I often wonder how much responsibility TV shows, particularly in the day and age we're in now, TV shows should have to try and be as accurate as possible when it comes to historical representation. Because obviously the most iconic image of a Viking has horns on his helmet.
Yeah.
Now obviously we know that comes from Wagner's, is it
It's the Ring Cycle, the Ring Cycle, yeah, the Nibelungen.
So we know it comes from that. So it comes from a piece of popular culture that has been represented a certain way, and it's just stuck. And we live in a society today where I feel like a lot of people get information from TV shows, from Netflix, from documentaries, so that from like visual media. So I think a lot of people, unfortunately, especially when they don't have a deeper interest in this, so they might be somebody who they just enjoy the show Vikings. They don't have any interest in deep diving into Nordic mythology, into the Viking Age. They have no interest in listening to podcasts like this. They just like the TV show.
Yeah.
So they're going to watch it and then just kind of assume that that's how it was and those things are real. And it's kind of like, what responsibility do we have to put as accurate as possible, because we want to keep things as secret? But also then the argument is, I don't know if you've seen The Northman. The Northman, I absolutely, I love what they attempted to do. I love the detail they went into. I love how they tried to be accurate. But also, I think a lot of lay people found it quite boring, because it was so detailed and so kind of nuanced into these different things that a lot of people who weren't interested were just like, oh, I don't really get this. But people who were interested were like, oh, that's cool. That's a little Easter egg. I recognize that from yeah. here. So it's like, I guess you've got to find that balance as well.
It is, yeah, because I think that that is a big thing with a balance. And I think that if you, for example, as an academic, I usually feel whenever I talk about, when I teach about, for example, the Viking Age or something like that, I usually go around just saying, we don't know. This is a theory. We found this, we don't know. It's just basically, I feel that my whole career can be summarized in I don't know.
This whole podcast is summarized in I don't know.
Yeah.
And maybes and what ifs. It's very rarely I ever have a guest on who's like, this is 100% the answer.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. And it's the same thing with when you go into any type of field, you will become fascinated first, and you learn more and more. But after a while, you start to see that what you're learning is actually just the kind of temple of knowledge you're building is actually starting to deconstruct itself, and suddenly you find yourself with different pathways and different interpretations which can be quite fascinating. I think it's quite interesting.
It's quite daunting as well, though, I think.
Yeah.
Because I guess I've probably done it more recently than you. And gone from a completely different thing. Like, I got quite interested into this from TV shows. Obviously, I have the business, but they all stem from maybe like the original first series of Vikings that I watched and then quite liked it. And then I went and bought I went to the Jorvik Viking Festival and bought a drinking horn that happened turned out to not be finished. It was just a raw horn. So me being me, I washed it, carved it, and just made it into like a nice little ornate thing for me that then got me interested in researching symbols. And I look back at that original horn now, I'm like, oh, this is terrible. I had no idea what any of this meant. But then the more I got into it, and then the more the business grew, and then when I started doing the podcast, I started to learn a lot more, again, sitting down with obviously some amazing people and learning more. It's like the less I felt I knew, even though the more I was learning, I feel like I know less every single time. Because on that surface level, when I was originally into it, you can just kind of look on websites that portray everything as accurate and you don't know any better.
No.
So you just kind of read it and you just assume, oh, we must know that this is true, this is true, this is true.
Mm.
And then you walk away from after reading it going, oh, we just know everything. And then when you start to look deeper, it's like, oh no, we, and it is that kind of block by block by block. You're almost in reverse where you realize you know less and less and less.
Yeah, I think, but and I think that's quite common. But I also think maybe in one way, Windy, that's kind of when I was, I mean, my first way into this was actually not through my way into like Nordic stuff was not through Nordic stuff, but actually through a more general interest in paganism.
Okay.
And my first thing, when I was, this is so this is my confession time, but when I was 18 years old, I lived in Utah. I was a high school student, and I discovered Wicca and witchcraft. And so, you know, so I started to read these books by Dorian Valiant, and I found it extremely fascinating. You know, wow, this secret movement.
Did you have long hair? I don't know why I feel like you would have had long hair.
I actually did have long hair.
I don't know why. I was thinking, I just could imagine you were like a young 18-year-old with long hair.
This typical hippie kid who just went around reading books about, you know, witchcraft. And
I just had like a little vision in my mind. I could just see you like.
And I mean, and I was so fascinated with that. I loved to read. I mean, I still have a very big fondness for Doreen Valiant's early books, even though, you know, later I learned a lot more stuff about her. Perhaps not everything was so positive. And of course, I learned that the whole idea about Gardner and the idea of a traditional witch cult and a Wicca and all of that was, you know, completely made up in the 1950s. So when I started to study religion academically, you know, it was a sense of disenchantment in a way, because you have to be thrown out of that kind of. But at the same time, there is another kind of obsession that emerges. It is the fact that we don't know much also means it's so much more exciting, and we learn more stuff every day, and we have different. Everything becomes muddier and. It's more the more clear it becomes more muddy, and I find it quite interesting.
It is fascinating, and I've often said on here how I think that's maybe one of the reasons why there is such a fascination around all of this, because we know so little, and people can apply it to themselves a lot easier than where there is a strict dogma or strict like book or whatever you can read and that says this is this. Where because it isn't that, you can just apply it to your everyday life and make it fit you personally rather than having to fit it, maybe.
Yeah, and I think that the Nordic culture has this perfect, in a way, perfect mix between not knowing much, but we know a little bit.
We know just enough.
We know just enough. We know names of gods. We know some stories. We have some idea about mythology. We have findings compared to, for example, like Celtic traditions that people definitely try to reconstruct, but we know next to nothing about their belief system. We have so little information. And I think that the strength with Nordic is that we know so little that we can sort of read into whatever we want, but we know enough to make us feel that we actually know something.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. So we can sort of convince us. So suddenly you have this idea of the Vikings were feminist, or the Vikings were actually nationalist, and the Vikings were into masculinity, or the Vikings were into protecting the environment, or they were, you know, you can make them anything. You can make them into race warriors or eco warriors, or and it has been done. It has been done in every single way. They are treated and used. I mean, I know that, for example, Rune Rasmussen hates when people talk about Vikings, but Nordic animism is using like all Norse symbols to talk about current environmental crisis, for example, and that is just as a relevant and a legitimate interpretation as anything else. Of course, the Viking Age didn't have a concept of that. They were not living in the same period. They didn't know about global warming. They perhaps, you know, had this in they had lived through an environmental disaster, of course, in the 500s. But so it can be used in so many different ways, and I think that's the strength of it. And you also see it in like music today. You have everything from this kind of band like Vardruna and Heilung, and then you have, of course, typical black metal bands that Amor Arat, and those of them might be more black death metal, I guess. But so you can sort of make anything you want of it, which is can be a good source of creativity. Although as an academic, you can sort of feel, I don't, I'm not sure I agree with this.
It is fascinating. Like I say, I'm terrible for looking in all the different Facebook groups, but I find it fascinating looking at how people do interpret it and the arguments, because no matter what is posted, like I saw a post the other day where somebody had done a very, I thought a very well researched post on the Blood Eagle, and I knew that it was good because I saw the Bob who's in the chat had liked the post, so I knew that it must have been somewhat well researched. So it was basically saying how maybe the Blood Eagle was a kenning for. When it comes to King Ayla being blood eagled, it could have been a kenning for King Ayla being killed and the eagles been having been covered in blood, which I thought was a really it was a really I thought reasoned post. But then the amount of people in the comments that are like, "Oh my God, you know absolutely nothing. This is complete bullshit. Try doing some research before you make a post." And I was like, "Oh, this is the I actually thought this was one of the first posts I've seen in a long time that." That was well thought out, and it was so very disappointing to see, but also very expected.
Well, I think that well, social media posts usually have this comment about doing more research if there's something you don't agree with. And you have your, if you do research, you will find, for example, like the Blood Eagle is a good example of that. There are many researchers who will claim that that's just a complete literally fabrication. There were never such a practice. That is just an invention. I think that's a majority opinion today, more or less. There are other.
But the idea of it is just so metal and
Exactly, it's so
cool
extremely metal.
that people can't let it go because it's
No.
just so cool, isn't it?
And you have some scholars who would argue there was a dissertation in Sweden quite recently about human sacrifices in the Viking Age that talks a lot about the blood eagle as a type of ritual practice. Now I'm not going to go into my opinions about that because I don't think I'm qualified to talk about that. But so if say do the research, you will find, I mean, in academia there is a lot of different opinions. There are a lot of different viewpoints that are can be equally well argued, even though they come to very different conclusions. You can, I mean, I personally is quite skeptical to the idea of Blood Eagle, and quite skeptical to the idea of that human sacrifices were common practice. I'm not saying it wasn't happening in rare occasions, or for the trolls were sacrificed, but I'm quite skeptical too, because the sources we have is usually, of course, Christian sources that are, and that it's also used for entertainment. But I do acknowledge that there are many good scholars who would disagree, and I'm since I'm studying contemporary reception of it. So I think when people say they do the research, it's kind of whose research are you talking about? Where are
There
you
is.
going? If you go to university, one of the first things I try to teach my students is actually to look at the different, not only different interpretations of religions, but different interpretations among scholars of all of these religions. And we're not only talking about, I mean, Old Norse religion. We can go into the whole nightmare of the early history of Christianity, for example, where you still have people will sort of argue with each other to a degree that they seems to literally hate each other, but they can both have very good arguments.
And one doesn't have and both can be right to a degree well. That's the thing. I remember on that post as well, one of my absolute not even a pet hate, just hate this answer. So there was somebody on there who said, I think the comment was like, oh, do some research. So I commented about, oh no, he's like, all your history is wrong or something. So I replied like, okay, what's wrong? What's wrong in the post? That and their reply was, oh well, you have Google, so look at it yourself. And it's like, I hate that. I hate that answer. Anybody listening to this, if you give that answer, fuck you. And I mean this in the kindest way, because it is just the biggest get out of not having a reply that there is. Because if you know the answer, you're just going to say it. Yeah. So it's just a kind of get out of jail free of just like, well, I'm not going to do your research for you. And it's like, then don't make the comment. If you don't have a reply, don't make the comment saying that it's wrong.
And I also think the basic fact is someone says use Google and in the context of research. I mean, that's the worst way you can start doing. If I wanted to do research about something, I will definitely use Google, but that's not sort of the main tool. That would be insane. You would sort of...
It is an absolute... it's a wild place. Because I've had times where... Because I try to do my best. I do enjoy it, so I can complain all I want, but I just enjoy. It's like my little hobby is to go and mess about in these groups. But I also try to use it to like educate people. And obviously, it's good promotion for the podcast if I can. But there'll be times where people will be talking about a certain topic. One that springs to mind is maybe like female warriors.
Yeah.
So I'll tag the... I'll put a link into the episode I did with Leshek Gedalia, who specializes in female warriors. That's like one of his things. He's written books on it. Probably knows more than most people. Well, he definitely knows more than most people.
Yeah.
And I'll put it in there, and then people will be like, "Oh yeah, just you talking to some guy." And it's like, you can't help you try and like give people. It's like, oh, I'm not going to listen to that, and it's just like, well, what do you want me to do? Like,
no, but I think
not going to get a better source than this.
No, but people have their very strong takes on that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's impossible to. I've been, I mean, that goes, but I've been definitely been in arguments with people on the internet, sometimes about more political issues than that. I usually don't get involved in political debates, but if someone says, for example, that, yeah, you know, that are basically empirically wrong, you can sort of tell them that this is literally not true. For example, there was a debate about, you know, it was some guy who claimed that, you know, there was thousands of mosques in Sweden. I said, no, it's just like single places, it's like five or something like that. It's extremely rare. I mean, basically because they are very poor at building them, and there's a lot of conflicts within it. But that's another religion, so we're not going to talk about that. But that's not an opinion. That's just an empirical fact. You can actually go out and count them. You can see, you know, talking about specific... That's not a matter of opinion. If it's like how many mosques there are, like this physical buildings only being treated as mosques in Sweden, that's just a matter of fact. Either it's a building is there or it's not. I mean, that's not a matter for debate. If it's good or not, that's a matter for debate. You can sort of argue that you like it or not, but how many is not something. But it seems to be, we come to, and I think that's a danger with social media, both from social political point of view, but also from a particular academic point of view, that views have started to become, this is something that I think everyone so I'm not definitely not the first one to say that, but it's the problem that, you know, people feel that you have to have some kind of direct answer to everything, and you have to have a quick answer to everything. Well, oftentimes situations can be extremely complicated. It's very difficult to give a straight answer. It's very difficult to say immediately why certain events have happened. So, I've been asked by sometimes Swedish media for different reasons to get very detailed opinions about maybe events that happened yesterday. And I feel that I can't really do that because we don't know much about it yet. Mm-hmm. Maybe in a year, there will be a good overview. And then in
We
3 years.
we should live in such a quick society where everything is now, and in a week, 2 weeks. No, people, you often see it where, and it's as sad as it is, the example that comes to mind is the Ukraine war. I remember when the Ukraine war started, I specifically said to my friends, I guarantee in a month nobody will be talking about this. And that doesn't mean that that I'm demeaning it or I don't think it's important, but I just knew exactly how the news cycle would be. And there was particular, I can't talk for everywhere in the world. It's obviously it's still going, it's still an issue. But I knew that in the UK particularly, that within a month, something else would have come along. And that's pretty much exactly what happened. There was this huge uproar, this huge focus of daily coverage for about a month, maybe a little bit longer. And then after that, something new has happened. Some other politician has fucked up, or some other country's done something here, or something's happened, and all the focus goes on that, and the other stuff is just kind of left behind.
We have a very short attention span in that sense. As a culture today, we have a very short memory span, which is quite frightening. And if we're talking about global news events like that, if we're talking about the war in Ukraine or other conflicts, for example, that people tend to forget immediately, we can talk about Burma that's still in a civil war, basically, that no one talks about. Most people don't even remember, you know, that there actually is such an event. When it comes to academia, that becomes a very big issue because academia is based, of course, that we have to have time. We have to have a lot of patience dealing with resources. We can't just throw out material immediately because then it's not grounded in proper research. It's just something we made up. And you have and I think I'm afraid that we will see that happening if there is a more intense pressure that everyone has to deliver a new radical new interpretation of something, that everyone has to sort of reinvent the wheel, we're going to have a lot more problematic research publications as well. But that's the problem. We can't, but you can't say don't trust researchers because then someone will go run off and go and listen to Ancient Aliens or something like that. But there is, of course, I mean, research is a complicated area, and there is different views. There are good and bad research, and some might be good but still be wrong, and that's complicated to explain.
Yeah, I've often wondered, we're way, way off topic now,
Yeah,
but
very way. We're way from the Nordic stuff now.
we're way off, but I'm enjoying the conversation, so hopefully other people listening are. But I often think this, and you can probably give me a more accurate answer, being of like the scholarly world, is I know me as a human, that if I was like an academic, that I would be dying to have some breakthrough research that was the first, or because I'm sure all academics want that kind of to be the first to do something, or to have some really important discovery or paper that's completely different to everyone else and it blows everything else out of the water. I'm sure that's got to be like an ambition. So it must be difficult to not lean towards maybe ideas that are different and chase them because and stay on track and not follow the ego, maybe.
It is difficult. I think everybody, as I said, everyone wants to be. I mean, I think there's so many scholars who are in my age and that are, I mean, both in history, religion, or in archaeology, that sort of grew up watching Indiana Jones movies and sort of became obsessed with them. And then you become an actual scholar and you realize, okay, well, it's not bad, but it's, you know. You can experience a lot of weird stuff depending on the type of research you're doing, going to metal festivals in Norway, for example. But I think that it's very appealing to try to find something that would rewrite all of history, and it's very it's a lure to be this kind of groundbreaking theorist or something like that is basically like alter everything. The problem is that it's probably not going to be that case. I mean, I'm very sorry to disappoint, but you're probably not going to become because that's not really how it works. It's very rarely that you find an artifact that you completely change of view of history. Most of us will not be Champollion, you know. We will not translate the hieroglyphs.
See, it seems we've had quite a few the last year, though. We had the oldest runestone, did we have? And the first inscription of Odin in runes. Those were in the last year. So if you, I don't know. This last year feels like we've had a bunch of like firsts.
There are a lot of stuff happening, and I think that it's for example, if you would find a runestone from the year 400, for example, that would say, "I love Jesus more than Thor," that would be quite radical.
Oh my God, I mean, that would be.
Because then you had to kind of rewrite the his not only history of Nordic societies, but also the whole history of Christianity, because that would be so. But it's very rare that we find that kind of runestones that are or that kind of find. But we do find, you know, we do find stuff all the time. And I mean, there are in many areas of the world, there's still new discoveries, and language codes are being cracked, and suddenly we can read pre-Christian ancient languages we couldn't read before. And that's great, but it's very rarely that someone just says Eureka and sort of discovers, you know, I have the code to this language. It's usually a long process, and it's many, many people involved, and it's most of the time a joint effort. I mean, we all dream of them making that big discovery or changing the field completely. And perhaps one day, maybe sort of one will, but that would be fun to be.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it would be. Okay, before I try to pull us back on track, I think as a society, we have a big problem with accepting when we're wrong, and forgiving people who are wrong about things, and allowing people to learn and change, because I assume that must happen all the time in academia, where you publish something that is maybe accurate to the best knowledge at the time, but then new information comes around and it's just like, oh, everything you've done is complete shit. And it wasn't shit at the time, but new things happen, and it kind of changed it, and that rings true, I think, throughout all of saying. A lot of people on social media could do better, and culturally we could do better, because you'll have somebody who's pulled up for something they said 15 years ago. I said, like, people change and adapt, and you have to allow people to change and adapt and change their opinions and learn and grow. That's what being a human is.
I agree. I mean, I can just look at my own research. I mean, this basically whenever I send in a publication, I always feel I should have changed that. I'm not happy with that. So I think that's a part of growing, and I think one has to allow people to change and have different opinions. Because I mean, it's very sad when people are stuck in the same kind of route all the time. I mean, my own dissertation is something that I sort of definitely would have sort of the passages there that I have would have liked to have rewritten based on my new knowledge I have and new information. And I think that's just natural. I think it would be strange if I would look at my own dissertation and feel, oh, this was the greatest thing ever written. I'm so great. That because then I would have been a quite bad scholar, to be honest.
Yeah, like I say, it's being a human. We all
Yeah,
we're
exactly.
hopefully, if you're in my opinion, if you're doing it right, then you're always learning, you're always adapting and growing, and moving forward. Okay, so we touched on the 1600s, and
Now we only
how,
have like a couple of hundred years left.
yeah. So is there any standout points where, like, Old Norse religion have been adapted or used, that jump out? I don't know. Is your specialist just in Sweden? or is it in general?
My main focus has been on Sweden because there are a lot of great scholars have written about the reception in Germany and other countries. Well, if we're talking of going back to track again after this, well, I think that's definitely the most significant thing that happened, and where definitely a lot of the stuff we claim to about talking about today is born is in the 1800s, of course, in the National Romantic movement, because that's where you have everything. You have the popularization of the Viking as a
Okay.
trope and as an identity.
So,
That's
sorry, just to clear up, I guess, in my own mind, because to me, that's like the Victorian era, in Britain. Is there What's the difference when it comes to Sweden? Obviously, you guys didn't have Queen Victoria, so it's not called the Victorian. Well, I guess is that running at the same time as the fascination in the Victorian?
This is a bit before. I think that the first wave of Viking fascination comes in the early 1800s in Sweden.
Okay, Victorians would be late.
And the early form is, well, you have a situation. Sweden has been to war with Russia, like they usually did, and they lost. They lo made terrible loss. They lost Finland, and basically all of Sweden felt that it was doomsday basically, and the situation was really, really bad in Sweden. They had lost the empire, the last remains of the Swedish Empire was gone, and there was literally a threat from Russia to more or less wiping Sweden out of the map. And it's so 1809 was one of the worst years in Swedish history, and so we have to remember that when we're talking about this. It's not Sweden as we know it today. It's not a kind of functioning democracy. It's a society more or less collapsing. It's basically a very poor, defeated country. And during this period, there is this group in 1811 is founded called the Götisch Association. That is a Swedish group in Uppsala again, that starts to they want to sort of regain a type of lost identity, particularly a lost masculinity. They're very obsessed with masculinity. And so they want to regain it, and they want, and they, this is something they mean can be found in the pre-Christian times, in the Viking era. So start to romanticize the Viking, and there's a poem by Erik Gustav Geijer called The Viking, which is a quite famous poem in Sweden, where it's about a 16-year-old boy who basically feels that his cabin is too narrow and he has to want to out and explores the sea. And this movement becomes quite significant. It's much more. It's a quite complicated movement. They are national romantics. They are inspired particularly by German Herder and the idea of Volkgeist, and they're also inspired by what's happening in Denmark. So it's but the main thing that they are interested in is the idea of in pre-Christian and Nordic traditions. They mean that there is some type of manhood that can be regained, and they want to get rid of everything that's seen as decadent. And decadent in their mind was synonymous with French, the French influence in the court, and French becomes identified with Greek. So there is this wonderful story about the Nordic gods visiting the Greek gods at Mount Olympus, and the Greek gods are just laughing at the kind of poor Nordic gods, and they're like jokes. And Freya is seen riding a pig, and they are embarrassed and goes away there. But after that, Kirion, I think, explains to the Greek gods that the Nordic gods are actually like the true gods. They are the purest forms because they are not decadent. They are not degenerates. They are pure in their kind of common man sense. That they are not into wealth and gold. They are sort of and you have from that movement a kind of a reception of the Viking Age that lives on until today. The idea of Viking mythology and by being very folky, popular, being not into extravagant stuff, being very sort of low, basically a representation of a Protestant ethic. Basically, you can see a Protestant Catholic conflict there. So I think that that's really one significant movement that appears, and they have been. I'm a little bit. I have a little small soft spot for the kind of this movement because they have been so critiqued afterwards, and they were critiqued when they came as well, because there were a lot of Swedish critics that considered the Gothic movement to be basically just, German Romanticism in Swedish disguise, and there was a revival of the old 1600s Gothic movement. But from them, we have a lot of the idea, the romantic view of the Vikings. It's the first translation in Swedish of the Poetic Edda, based on a Danish translation. And there's also quite interesting religious idea that spread. They had, of course, positive view of paganism, which was. They were criticized for it. Some people didn't really like it, and there were some attempts to even create initiatory societies based on Nordic mythology. Didn't really work out that well. But they also had very interesting ideas about Christianity. Many of them were into Swedenborgianism, so they were not really conventional in that sense. Even though most of the members of this movement were priests and bishops in the Church of Sweden. But you find similar movements all around, like in Norway, and you have find them in Denmark as well, of course, because Denmark was a great source of inspiration. A bit major thing and difference, and I talked to this about Norwegian colleagues, was that in Norway they wanted to become independent, they wanted to be free, so they were focusing on the king to be as a symbol of Norway. While in Sweden, the idea was basically more rejecting the king, seeing the king as someone who had to be controlled, and that's why you have the ideal of the free farmer or the odal farmer, based on for odal rune. So I think that's and so I think from that period we actually have the modern day reception. You find it later. A lot of the stuff that you find in Swedish art from the Viking Age, not from the Vikings, but about the Viking Age, are from the late 19th century or late 1800s. And then it's during the same period as the Victorian era, of course. And it's quite similar. A lot of men fighting, a lot of men with boats, and also like a lot of idealized images of Thor as a very hyper masculine guy fighting giants, but there is always and there is a shift, continual shift in how this is viewed. Some view in the early 1800s, the focus is more on loyalty to your people and sort of self-sacrifice, while in the late 1800s it's more, the Viking is an entrepreneur, we have the growth of capitalism or industrial capitalism becoming more prominent. So, and I think that there is, during this period, you have a similarities with the British, and not sure how much influence it was from the British. Sweden always historically has gone back and forth for a long time with England versus French or Germany as being the main source of inspiration.
It is fascinating how this relatively short period of time in history just seems to keep cropping up, and having a fascination with it throughout history, time and time and time again. And I can't think of another kind of time or mythology, I guess, other than like the Abrahamic faiths, which just have always kind of been there. One that just really just pops up and as always keeps just coming back, and people just love it. But even like Dolthar said, the Roman Empire, but I don't think it does. I don't think Roman and Greek have the same impact, particularly globally, as the Viking Age. There's just something about it in the mythology that just doesn't. It just seems to cling on to people, and it's clear through like the 1600s, the 1800s. It's just there.
It recurs again and again. And I also think it's interesting because we're talking about, as in, compared to, for example, the Roman Empire, or even more so the Egyptian civilization, we're talking about that extremely short time period. We're not talking about thousands of years, we're talking about hundreds
Well,
of years.
because the Egyptians were around for what, 3,000 years?
Even more so. I mean, we talk, it's that depends on where it starts counting, but yeah. Between 4,000 to 3,000 years, depending on which way you want to start, but definitely 3,000 years.
Which is, to put that into perspective, that's more time than from when they, from the fall of like the Egyptian Empire to now.
Yeah.
That's as long as the Egyptian Empire was
yeah.
a thing. So when you're talking about like the Viking Age, which is what, 300 years?
Yeah.
It's a huge difference, but the impact that this little short period of time has, particularly on like Northern Europe and Northern America, is
yeah,
pretty incredible.
It comes back over and over, and I think that because that's another part of the reception that we haven't talked a lot about at all, but that's also an equally ideological reception is the attempts to deconstruct the Viking Age. Because in the same way that you have people are fascinated with the Viking Age, there's always been attempts to deconstruct it, to sort of say there never was a Viking Age, we don't know anything about it, and the old Uppsala was just a garbage dump. But it never seems to work. It comes back again and again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And you see in Sweden particularly, you could see it with some... to be a little bit generalizing, left-wing writers who were from the 1968 generation, you know, the kind of people who liked Chairman Mao. Mm-hmm. So we definitely have this idea of that they really wanted it in the 1970s and 80s. There was a lot of talk about, you know, deconstructing the idea of the Viking, and there was very kind of negative portrayals of it, that it was everything was dirty and it was, you know, primitive, and because of course the idea was that if people started to become interested in the Viking Age, everyone would, you know, sort of run out and become a Nazi, and you know, so you start listening to Heilung, and then suddenly not Heilung because they didn't exist back then, but you know, the similarity would be that, you know, everyone at Midgårdsblot is, you know, in secret a Nazi in becoming, mm-hmm. more or less. But it didn't work out, and there is no evidence that people became Nazis either. And in the 1990s, it became more, you know, popular again. You had Viking fairs, you had the first wave of the kind of folk music that sort of later you have today bands that are continuing this trend. It never seems to go away. And there is something, I think that, for example, in country Scandinavian countries, it is quite fascinating to have this kind of history where, you know, you have had a different religion than most people have today. There's also a kind of a more dangerous society in a culture that is actually quite safe, mm-hmm. Despite, you know, news reports or everything in Scandinavian countries, and including Sweden, is very safe countries. And so it becomes this contrast. And I think that's kind of fascinating that you can sort of imagine that you are a Viking, and then you go to your job at the university or post office or, you know, whatever you happen to work at, or a department. So it becomes this interesting contrast. And I think that's one of the appeals to it. And it's fascinating. I mean, it is a fascinating period of time. It is a quite interesting period of time. Although most people want to have this more perhaps romantic view. It's more fun. At least it makes better television. When I was growing up, we were taught a lot about, you know, the Viking Age based on a more social realist framework. It was basically, we should learn, you know, that how the people were, you know, properly farming and everything like that.
Yeah.
That's definitely more correct view of it. I mean, the majority were farmers, they were not Vikings.
Not as fun, though.
Oh, sorry?
Not as fun.
No, it's not as fun. I mean, who wants to see a movie called The Farmer about a guy? So, I mean, maybe some, but, you know, having a television series about some guy who lives in Uppland or something like that, who's just an ordinary farmer, and he hears stories about someone going Viking and that, but usually just lives his life with his family.
Yeah.
Probably he's wouldn't very, be.
He's a safe choice.
Yeah.
I mean, what's it like, I guess, as a Scandinavian, to have all this interest in such a positive light about the history? I guess as a Brit, even though the Viking Age plays a huge part in British history, for the most part, people look at British history very negatively. we were not very nice people all over the world. So I guess it's always nobody's looking at the British Empire or anything that we've done throughout history in a very romantic light. Whereas that is happening to Scandinavians. And does that ever, I don't know, does that, is there any sort of pride behind that of like how much people do look at this and keep coming back to it and looking at it and enjoying it? And, or is it not even thought of? Is it just something that happens? Are you even aware of it?
It's, I mean, this is just speculation on my part, but since I'm not writing a dissertation now, I can sort of just go with my feeling and sort of, but I think that there is a sense of pride to it. I think there is a sense of the Viking Age. I mean, considering if you look at the number of Viking villages in Sweden, for example, there's always this kind of reconstructed way they might have Viking fairs or and you have and I mean there is this sense of there's still a large subculture of people are sort of doing this kind of reenactment and things like that. And I think most people are aware of it. Most people, it's not something that I think a daily Swede would think about many times a day, but if you sort of ask them, I think most people find it quite fun, quite fascinating. I think one reason perhaps is that, I mean, first of all, we're talking about a very, I mean, compared to like the British Empire, which you still see the sort of the effects of colonialism in many countries.
Yeah, I guess it's still quite recent when you're in human history. But I guess for me, it's quite an embarrassing time of history, and that's kind of what I was thinking of. That it is just it seems, something that you can't take any pride in what the British Empire did. It is an embarrassing part of our history, whereas maybe it is the time pass, because I mean, ultimately the Vikings were quite brutal, and they were going around and colonizing other areas and just going in. So it's, but is it, do you think it's the time, because there's been so much time that's passed?
I think it's time has passed, but I also think that you have, for example, you have quite small countries you're dealing with. You're dealing with Sweden and Norway, Denmark and Iceland primarily. They are not particularly, when you think about Sweden today, you're not thinking about war. It's not really like the first thing that comes to your mind, at least unless you're a historian. So there is this kind of image today, this kind of small, maybe a little bit too safe. So it's kind of fun to have this kind of, yeah, but we have this kind of dark past. We used to burn down villages. We used to be this kind of conquering barbarians that came ashore and plundered monasteries. So I think that there is a sense of I won't compare it to the Norwegian embrace of black metal, but it's something quite fun with this kind of polarity between like contemporary Swedish society and this feeling that there is this kind of this hidden barbarian underground. I mean, you can see there is a large interest in history, definitely, for example, in Sweden. You do see history books being selling a lot, and people are very interested in hearing about history. But it's always stuck in the Viking Age. I mean, when it comes to identity and I mean, people are quite interested in the history of the Swedish Empire and perhaps of that, but it doesn't really have the same cultural impact. Even though, I mean, of course, we are, it's directly affecting us more what happened in the 1700s and 1800s. But I think that there is this the Viking Age is a little bit more, you're getting closer to some type of fantasy, Tolkien-esque world.
Yeah, it is truly fascinating, because I guess to look at the British Empire, it's unarguably the I don't know if greatest is the right word. The most successful empire that there's ever been is probably the British Empire. I think there's some ridiculous stat that we at some point occupied 98% of the planet. At some point, like those countries, 98% of the countries in the world have been under British rule. It's a ridiculous number. But I can't imagine in 1,000 years people are going to look back on the British Empire in the same way that we look back on the Viking Age now. So there is something very special about those 300 years that kind of do just.
Yeah, I mean, you can compare to even though people apparently a lot of people think about the Roman Empire all the
Yeah, I
time.
saw that on TikTok, apparently.
We don't really have the same romantic view of the Roman Empire either. We don't, you know, people
No.
might quote Caesar or Augustus, and I'm sure people already quoting Churchill and, you know, some of the leaders of the British Empire, but we don't have the same fascination. No, but this, yeah, I think that there is something. The Viking Age is a very special, and it was the last for Scandinavia. It was the last major pagan civilization after the Viking Age. Ended it. Sweden and Norway and Denmark and Iceland became part of Christian Europe. Then now we kind of consciously forget about the Samis and the Finns, but you know,
Yeah.
that's another story. But so there is, of course, also who has the power to write the history has to be related to this. But I think that there is something, and I don't think we're ever going to get rid of it. I mean, again, if we're talking about, there has been attempts, and I think that, you know, you have definitely people in the heathen or pagan communities that are very, who are working with Nordic mythology and Nordic gods, that are very, very tired of the Viking stuff, and they want to get rid of it. But you can't. It's impossible to get rid of the Viking stuff. You can't, because that's where we have all the sources. You can talk and as much as you want to, you know, trying to find alternatives. But the Viking trope is so stuck in this kind of cultural framework that it's impossible. When someone mentioned Thor and Odin, we immediately think about the Viking Age. When someone talking about the Scandinavia in the Iron Ages, it's like the Viking Age, and that's going to continue. We're never gonna get rid of the Viking Age. It might matter more or less during different periods of time. It might be more or less significant, but if you go today, I mean, just in this here in Stockholm, if you go to the old town in Stockholm, there are so much Viking crap t-shirts. I mean, it's t-shirts, it's jewelry, and it's some of it is good, some of it is actually quite nice. But it's, and you can also go to the historical museum in Stockholm, and it's like the major part of it is like the thing they made most effort on is on the Viking exhibition, and it's a good Viking exhibition. It's quite a good, but it's quite clear that still the fascination is about the Viking Age. You see it both when it becomes critical studies or negative portrayals. For example, even the people who want to deconstruct the Viking Age, they always focus on the Viking Age. We don't really talk about deconstructing the Bronze Age in the same way. I mean,
No.
it's easier to do, but so I think there's something to it. Yeah, there's something we can't get rid of it.
No.
We're going to be talking about yeah, but I think we're going to have new way. There's going to be trends, you know. In now we have this kind of the barbarian, the kind of proto-feminist barbarian that we find from Vikings, and in 20 years we might have another
Yeah,
interpretation of it.
it just seems to transform and
Yeah.
change and stick around forever. Okay, Frederick, we're gonna end up going down more rabbit holes than Alice, so we should
Yeah.
probably wrap this up because
This has been going on for a long time.
we're gonna be here all night. I could sit and talk to you for hours. This has been a lot of fun. We've gone off topic, but I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And usually, if I'm enjoying it, then other people will as well. So, let's wrap up the main show and we'll do a short, just a little short Q&A with the patrons, if you've got time, maybe like 15 minutes.
Yeah, no problem.
We can do that. And so, yeah, I really enjoyed it. Do you have anywhere you want people to follow you, or any books, anything you want to promote, I guess?
Well, they can always follow the Back to Blood project, of course. That's always nice. Pursuing a Future from the North Past. We are on Facebook because we're apparently not that good at new social media. We don't have a TikTok, but we have Back to Blood. I have an Instagram account. It's not only about Nordic stuff. It's about just generally my own interest, which can be everything from voodoo and to Aleister Crowley. But you know, there's sometimes there's a Viking showing up.
Yeah,
back in that. So,
is that just under your name?
Yeah, that's just my name. But I think that if I want to promote something, it should be the Back to Blood project, because I think that's where we plan to publish most of the research we're doing. And this is, of course, a project that not only involves me, it also involves Janne Skoldi and Anna Ekström is also a PhD candidate, and Tao Mikkefjell, so is also from Denmark. So we have it's a good group of Wonderful. Scholars who are studying together.
Wonderful. Yeah. So everybody go and check that out. If you want to follow me, it's Daniel and Scott Farron, one, obviously the business at Horns of Odin. And then it's just the Nordic Mythology podcast on Instagram, Facebook, all the usual places. And don't forget, obviously, we have our YouTube channel where you can watch all the episodes. I had Terry Gunnell on a couple of episodes ago, and he brought a nice little slideshow to the show. So, you know, there are benefits to watching rather than just listening, and you get to see our pretty faces. So, you know, there are benefits. Frederick, thank you very much. When I met you at Midgardsplan, knew that when we eventually did this, we would just be able to sit and talk, and it did not disappoint.
Thank you. It was great fun to be here.
Perfect. Thank you.